Today is Sunday, February 28th, 2021. This is part 6 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Jim Haggart, H-A-G-G-A-R-T. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Jim. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Tom. It's good to hear from you.
You too. Thanks so much for continuing on with this oral history here. Jim, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
For sure. Yeah, please
Thank
go
you.
Ahead.
Thanks so much. We ended up part 5. You had walked us along the Butte Fault, and you'd hiked up Chuar Butte and Temple Butte and Ahwatobee Crest, and had hoped to get to Quaggont, but that didn't happen, and had to back out of there. And so I'm wondering if you could tell us a couple things. One is, what was it like getting permits then, and when did you finally summit Quaggont?
Sure, yeah, permits. Well, that's an interesting question, a very interesting question. Of course, the first few hikes I did in the canyon in the very early 70s did not require any permits. I think you might have had to get a permit to camp at Phantom Ranch, but at the Bright Angel Campground down there, and maybe at Indian Gardens too. But I don't believe that you had to get permits for overnight backpacking that would be considered off the main arterial corridors. But in any event, when they implemented that permitting system in the early 70s, we did follow the rules. And it must have been around 73 or something like that. I'm sure one could research the records of the NPS mm-hmm. and find out when they implemented this system. But I remember by the time that they implemented it, it was getting to the point where I'd hiked most of the non-maintained trails. And that, you know, are listed in treks, or there was a nice little pamphlet that was available at that time that described the non-maintained trails. It was produced, I think it was printed by either the Park Service or the Natural History Association.
Okay.
In any event, you know, we kind of refer to these documents religiously, and of course, you know, you wanted to check off all the trails. And so, you know, I had a pretty good understanding of backcountry routes as far as the trails go. And so when they implemented this system of permitting, I remember, you know, at the beginning you had to show up with your pack and all your gear, and they would go through your pack to check your gear to make sure
Wow.
it was appropriate for hiking in the canyon. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I mean, I can understand where they're coming from, because, you know, in many cases they would have people who would come over prepared, right, with too much gear, and you know, given the heat in the canyon, and particularly in the summer, if you have too much gear, it can be a real problem. And I think they were trying to do their best to be helpful to people,
mm-hmm.
but quite honestly, I kind of felt, and maybe this was my youthful, you know, pride and whatnot, I just kind of felt like these people don't really know what they're doing, and they're asking us to qualify our trips and talk about our background experience, it was a challenge to do that, but we did it. You know, we did it. We would get the permits, and eventually, they dispensed with the inspections of your gear. And it got to the point where you would just go to the old Park Service headquarters, which was over by the cemetery.
Yep.
I'm not sure what occupies that building now. And there was a desk there, and you could register for hiking, and they overnight hiking. And
so
they
this
would
was,
take your deed.
This was into the courtyard where the boats were, back in there somewhere?
It was just outside, you know, as you entered through the glass doors into the courtyard.
Yep.
From the main lobby.
Yep.
It was on the right side of the lobby.
Okay.
So when you walked in from the front of the building through those glass doors there would be the desk over to the right, and there
yes.
was that's where you would sign up, right?
Right.
And I don't recall too much of the rest of the structure. If you went to the left, there was there was a big display gallery,
and
I think if you continued to the right and went, I think north from that to the left of that sign-up desk, there were washrooms down there and telephone and things like that. So, and I remember it. This kind of plays into the story. There was a phone booth outside of the front entrance to the west side on the left, and so you would go in and you would you know, initially the first couple times we had to show our gear, and but then they relaxed that. I guess they probably figured it took too much time, and then they would ask you to list all your, you know, your expertise and what you, your qualifications, and so, you know, we were pretty flippant, and we would just say all non-maintained trails, right, or something like that.
Right.
And then, you know, 2 months in Wyoming in summer of 70, 71, and 6 weeks in Wyoming, and et cetera. You know, we were being pretty flippant because, of course, we knew better than
first ascent Horace, right? First ascent Ra, first ascent Set.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Just knocking them out.
Yeah. But. You know, when you it got to be that, you know, you had to show up at this desk to get your permit, right? And if you're going to be going on a trip in some remote area, like in the Fossil Bay, for instance, the last thing you want to do is go into the village and spend all that time getting this permit. And so it was a real challenge because you couldn't call it by phone and make a permit. You couldn't, maybe you could have mailed it in. Of course, this is long before the internet. So you may have been able to mail it in. But then again, you know, you have no control over the timing and if you have to change your plans, et cetera. So, you know, it got to be really onerous. And then on top of that, we realized that, you know, the first few times we got our permits, we would come off of the trip and we'd go to that phone booth at the visitor center. Because it would always be late at night. It seemingly was always late at night when I came out of the canyon.
Right.
And we would dial the number, and there would be a recording that you could leave that said, "This is Jim Haggard. You know, my party got out of the Grand Canyon today, blah, 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 and everything's fine."
Was that part of your permit that you had to call the number and tell them you were out?
That was. Okay. You had to either... Yeah, you know, you could have, of course, you could have, if you had finished earlier in the day, you could have walked into that visitor center and told them that, you know, personally that you were finished. But if you got back late after the visitor center was closed, the idea was you call and let them know. And I mean, this makes sense. Obviously, you know why that was happening. You know,
sure.
But it got to be such a challenge to get these permits when you were going to remote areas that, you know, we just started to see it as more trouble than it was worth. And then they implemented the fees. And that was another thing too. You had to start paying a fee to go overnight camping. And this was ostensibly to pay for this new system that they were implementing to kind of allocate people into various use areas. And so you must be familiar with the use areas.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Tell the listeners about that, the use areas.
Sure, sure. Well, the hiking use areas are essentially, there must be like 70, 75 of them for the main part of the park. And what the Park Service attempted to do was to identify areas of high hiker use and kind of limit the number of hikers that could go into any one of these areas at any one time, you know, which sounds reasonable. I quite accept it. And so, for instance, you'd have a little use area, which would be in the Clear Creek area east of Phantom Ranch. And I actually think at the time that they split Clear Creek kind of in two geographically along an east-west line, such that Upper Clear Creek above where the campground is, or maybe above Shayava Falls, I'm not sure, but you know, that was one area that was separate from the main area where all the hikers went to. In any event, the idea was to monitor and minimize the number of people camping in one area at any one time. So mm-hmm. you would minimize environmental damage, and you would maximize the experience for the hiker because there wouldn't be hordes of people there, you know. Right. And we've all been in places in the canyon, you know, like Havasu and whatnot, at the key times when there's just way overloaded. It's way overloaded with crowds and mm-hmm. hikers, and so, you know, there was really good reason for doing this. But these boundaries of these use areas seem to be fairly arbitrarily designated, and so you would have an area like, let's say all of the Clear Creek drainage, you know, which is from Crystal Rapids all the way up Dragon Creek to Little Dragon, and then along the rim and then down Crystal Creek itself, back down to the river, right? That would be one area, and they would say, well, we only want five people in there, right?
Mm.
And so it's like, yeah, okay, well, I'm sorry, you can't go in there because there's a party of four that are camped down in the Crystal in the Tapeats, and we don't want you going into the upper part of Dragon to do your trip down the arms there and connect and go back out to the North Rim because you're going to be in their area. Even though we were going to be within 5 miles of them,
right?
We were told, no, you can't go into that area because, you know, the numbers of people in there has already reached the limit. And that became an additional frustration because you didn't know, right? You didn't know how many people were where at what time. It was totally up to the Park Service. So you would put in a request. That's right. Now I recall there was a mail option, and we tried this several times. You'd put in a request, and it would come back, and they'd say, well, no, we can't give you that permit because there's people, you know, planning to be in that use area already. And it was like pulling your hair out, right, to try and get any permits to go places. And quite frankly, when that happens, you know, people just say, well, you know, what's the point of it, right? If it's too problematic and too difficult, I'm not going to want to work with the system.
Right.
You know,
people go elsewhere or they poach.
That's right. And I experience this in my work these days. I mean, you know, I'm a research scientist. I write scientific papers, and the administrators and bureaucrats in Ottawa are constantly thinking of things to make our workload more of a challenge.
Hmm.
And consequently reducing the time we can spend on research.
Hmm.
And I constantly am fighting back against this because it's very inefficient from my perspective. And anyways, in a nutshell, that was kind of the rationale for why the permit system came to be seen as fairly onerous. Now, and so consequently, you know, basically starting in around 74 or 5, I think, we just didn't even get permits anymore. We would just bypass the whole thing.
Okay.
And so, you know, we've talked about a number of hikes and trips that I've taken, you know, that I took, but there were a lot more that I haven't talked to you about, right?
Right.
And so
right.
There was lots of hiking adventures that, you know, that I'm referring to here where we just dispense with the permits. And it kind of became, I hate to say this because I know Park Service is going to, you know, potentially hear this in the long run, but it kind of became a working joke, you know, that, you know, did you get the permit? No. Yeah, I got it. It's in the pack, you know, and well, it's supposed to be displayed on the outside of the pack,
right.
But you know, once in a while you'd run into a ranger and chat about this problem, and nobody, the rangers, I think, on the ground were sympathetic. I mean, we never got fined or anything like that. Once my friend Art got fined. We can talk about that if you want to later.
We should, because I think that was recently, wasn't it, the last couple of years?
Well, it was about 10 years ago.
Oh, 10 years ago. Okay. Well, when we get
unless he's gotten fined for a second time that he didn't tell me about.
When we get to 2010, maybe we'll pick that up because It's kind of interesting. The people that were grandfathered into the system, if you will, that were hiking there before the permit system came in, and then found the system incredibly burdensome, and instead of trying to change the system, they simply just went without, and said, "Well, we'll just take our chances with the rangers when we find them."
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's really, keep in mind, it's really hard to change the system, as you mentioned, if you don't work with the National Park Service, especially in 1975, right?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, you know, and like I was in college and university, and I had other things to do than start a big campaign to change this. Although, you know, I could have done that. I'm not saying I couldn't have done that.
Right.
But we did try to, you know, like I say, we ran into rangers a couple times, not only hiking in the canyon, but, you know, like, I stayed overnight in rangers' trailers or cabins once in a while, and we would chat, and they would ask, you know, permits quite often came up, and you know, I would explain, well, typically we tend not to get the permits because it's more of a challenge, and the rangers wanted to know how to make it better, and I think in the long run they wanted to improve it, and they, you know, I think they went a long way to doing that with the online system. Although many of these use areas have not been contracted, right? There's still some very large areas. The last time I looked at the map of use areas, which was 4 or 5 years ago, I think, there's still some very large areas where you could expect to find very few numbers of people. And that seems to be a continuing issue, but nonetheless, I think that the Park Service, they did want to respond to the criticism that we were leveling against them. You know, not public criticism, but amongst ourselves, right? Mm-hmm. And so eventually, I did start getting permits again once in a while, and if we thought we were going to be on a trip that was high visibility, then we would, you know, often get a permit.
Yeah.
So there was one trip where this was early on, back when we would normally get permits. Oh yeah, here, that's the same issue coming up again. And my friend Chris and I and a friend of ours named Harold Sturgis wanted to go into Clear Creek. And this was in the winter of like 74. Four, something like that, and maybe 75, and we wanted to go into Clear Creek on a hiking trip, not a climbing trip, but a hiking trip, and we went to the South Rim, and we tried to get the permit, and they said, oh, you can't go in there, it's closed, right, there's too many people in there. I said, oh, shoot, right, so, and we wanted to go up into the upper drainage of Clear Creek and spend time up in there. They said it's closed off. And so we're thinking quickly here on my feet, and I said, well, how about if we go down the Grand View Trail and then walk across the Tonto to the Kaibab, you know, and just spend a couple days there.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, well, you can't do that because there's too much snow on the top of the Grand View Trail.
Hmm.
And I just looked at my friend Chris, you know, and we looked at each other, and, you know, by this time we'd been spending summers in Wyoming up on glaciers and, you know, all sorts of mountaineering type adventures. And it's like, I've been down the Grand View Trail 4 or 5 times at this point. I know what the trail is like. And, you know, 14 inches of snow is not going to be a problem. But they said, no, it's closed. You can't get a permit for that. So, oh, I'm sorry. I got the story a little mixed up here. Yes, that was our original intent, was to go down the Grand View across to the Kaibab.
Okay.
But we couldn't get the permit because of the snow on the top of the Grand View Trail.
Okay.
So we came up with the idea of getting the alternate permit to go into Clear Creek. That's what it was. So we had a permit to go to Clear Creek, and we just kind of, okay, we got our permit now. We're in the system,
right?
And we paid our $2 or whatever it was. It was really cheap at that time, and then we promptly went to the Grand View Trail, right?
Okay.
And left our car at Yaki Point there and hitchhiked over to the Grand View Trail and went down the trail. It was no problem. It was simple, right? It was just a lot of snow.
Yeah.
And so we were sitting there in Grapevine Creek, So we this was like a 5-day trip, and we were exploring down the drainages to the river, et cetera,
cool.
right? And taking our time. And we were sitting in Grapevine, and there had been like a storm and some bad weather. We had a tent. Again, I think I told you when, about this Holubar tent that I carried on some trips in the winter.
Yeah.
We carried that on our ascent of Horus, for instance. And anyways, we had this tent, which was a two-man mountaineering tent. The three of us were in there, and it was bright orange, of course, because, you know, in the mountains, you know, you want visibility, et cetera. So we're, of course, it's midwinter. And, you know, all the leaves are off the trees. So we're camped there in Grapevine. And early morning, we're just kind of relaxing in the tent. We hear, wah, 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 you know, helicopter, right? Oh, boy, this is pretty interesting. Well, we were nervous enough and paranoid enough that we were concerned that, you know, the Park Service might see us. And but there was nothing we could do. You know, we can't go out there, and it, just going outside the tent would make it even more obvious, right, that somebody was down there. So, you know, it flew around once or twice, and then it just homed in on us, and it came down, right?
Mm.
We could hear it coming down and landing just a little ways downstream. So we hop out of the tent and run over there, and a ranger comes up, and he says, "Have you seen this fellow, any other hikers?" And we said, "No," and the reason was a hiker had gone missing up on the Nankweeb Trail. I'm sorry, the Tanner Trail.
Oh, okay.
And in a winter storm, right, failed to come back up the trail, we said, "No, we haven't seen him," we can keep our eyes open. And the ranger said, "Okay, thanks. You know, we thought you might be him, right?
Right.
Because you're kind of the only people down here, and so we wanted to check up on that." And he said, "By the way, do you have a permit for this hike?" And I said, "Well, we have a permit, but it's not exactly for here." So I fished the permit out, and I showed it to him. And, of course, he reads that we're supposed to be in Clear Creek, which is kind of like directly across the river, you know.
Right.
And he says, you boys realize you're not, you know, where you're supposed to be." And we kind of sheepishly said, "Yes, sir. You know, we're not following the plan." And so he kind of admonished us and said, "You know, the reason we have these permits is to keep track of people and, you know, to go after people if they're missing. And if you don't follow your permit, then it makes it really hard for us to do our job." And of course, we understand all that. You know, it makes total sense. And so he said, "Okay, I'm going to let it go. Just get back over where you're supposed to be."
Right, working on it. You bet.
Yeah, right. We said, "Yes, sir. You know, we'll do that." And so they took off, and of course we just continued our trip the way we'd planned, and didn't go to Clear Creek. But we were very paranoid because we heard that helicopter flying around a lot, you know.
Mm.
And it turns out the guy actually died up there of exposure. They found him.
Hmm.
They found him on the Tanner Trail. He was actually off the trail a little ways, but I guess he was coming up, and when that storm hit, mislaid the trail, and got off it, and then died of exposure.
That's
so
tough.
You know, a serious incident.
Yeah.
That impacted us minimally, but you know, it certainly impressed upon us the importance of the permit system. For some situations, you know, so overall, I think any place like Grand Canyon, which has the numbers of visitors and an exploding use, particularly as was seen in that period of time in the mid-70s, you know, with people going into the backcountry, you need to control it. And you know, Park Service did the best they could with probably very limited resources.
Mm-hmm.
I know how government works, you know. You don't get the money you need to do things right. But of course, you know, being young punks, we thought we knew better than anybody else, and we would do our own thing, right? And quite honestly, Tom, if I had sticked to that permit regime and every trip I went on was with a proper permit, I probably wouldn't have half or a third the hikes and climbs that I've actually undertaken, you know, because it did limit you quite a bit. So
did you ever run into other hikers that were in the zone they were supposed to be in, and you guys just sort of appeared, there you are? And they're like, hey, how are you? And I'm like, fine. And
We never got to the point. First of all, we would rarely run into people, right?
Okay,
because
right.
we weren't interested in going the standard places.
Right,
and and at that time in the, you know, in the 70s and even 80s, I think there weren't too many people who were going away from the standard places,
mm-hmm.
you know. And that would be, you know, like Deer Creek. There'd be Clear Creek. There'd be a lot of people in Clear Creek, but they'd all be clustered
right.
in the area from, you know, the campground up to Shayava Falls,
mm-hmm.
right? A few of them might go down river, but there's a, you know, fairly challenging little down climb around the waterfall down, you know, close to the river, so you can't get there unless you're, you know, a pretty competent scrambler.
Right.
And so people would be really restricted in their where they stayed and visited, and we weren't going there because we, you know, kind of hit all these classic spots, the high profile spots from the very first few hikes we did in the canyon, and so the idea was we wanted to go elsewhere. So you know, and when we did run into hikers, nobody said, "Let's see your permit." You know,
mm-hmm.
there wasn't any sort of challenge or questioning about that. I mean, I can't remember actually running into that many hikers where strangers. Ran into friends once in a while, unexpectedly, but
mm-hmm.
I can't remember actually running into strangers where, you know, we initiated discussions about our hikes and
right.
you know, permits and things like that. So,
and the reality
yeah,
is the number of people doing the climbs and the hikes you guys were doing is pretty small.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, you know, there's a lot of people there. Clear Creek, they're doing the Tanner, and they're doing, you know, New Hants, and they're doing Hermit. But you know, go climb Quaggan, or, you know, go climb Ra or Set or Horus. Yeah, you've got to walk through a busy area. Maybe you're going to use the Phantom Corridor, the Trans-Cross Canyon Corridor. But then you're going to walk away from that and head off into places that very few people go. Or
yeah.
at least at that
yeah.
time we're going. Now, not so much. Now there's more people. There's
For sure. There, yeah. There's been a dramatic expansion from what I can see in the use of the backcountry. Although I'm still kind of amazed when I go into certain places like Nankweep, and you know, you'll see people. Maybe you'll see some people, two people or three people on the trail. Maybe not definitively guaranteed. And maybe you'll see somebody camp down at the standard campground down there, right?
Right.
But you can get lost in there very, very easily. You know, you know, 10 people in Nankweep can get dispersed very quickly, you know, it's really a very minimal impact.
Well,
so,
it is interesting as we're having this discussion right now. There are two, if not three, groups walking the length of Grand Canyon right now, and that's a first. So the you know, what we used to think of really remote areas now have people walking through them you know, way more often than they ever had. So it's really kind of fascinating to look at this,
yeah.
Think about that, put it in perspective, what was going on in the 1970s compared to what's going on in 2021.
Yeah. Well, of course, now there's so much information available, right?
Yep,
you know,
that's true.
In the mid-70s, you know, the only person who had done any sort of a through route was Colin Fletcher, right? And, of course, Harvey Butchert had pieced together, you know, a route through the Grand Canyon.
That's right.
Not necessarily the full length down to the Grand Wash Cliffs, of course, but you know, the main part from Nankweep down to Supai, that area in there. And Butchert had linked that together, and he actually did that. Remember that? He did
yep,
the final
he,
link in
he
that
did,
like a couple
and,
months before.
And Fletcher did it,
Fletcher.
And then just not long after Fletcher was Hildreth and Fulton. So there's a, you know, a number of people were in there doing it, but they certainly weren't, like I say, they certainly weren't west of Havasu, or north of Naqueet. Now, some people were. Ron Mitchell was north of Naqueet. Harvey was a little bit north,
yeah.
north of Eber Glendenning was north of Naqueet. So it's, you know, there were some people out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And there was no internet, so you couldn't broadcast your exploits. You know, there was the only maps we had were those 1-62.5 maps, you know, the 30-minute maps that showed very generalized routes, but you could never get a definitive idea that something would go like you can from a 7.5. Even that's not definitive necessarily, but you get a much better idea.
Right.
So yeah, it was definitely stacked against people, but that was the attraction. I mean, let's face it, if I really just value so much the experience that we had then, not knowing this information, you
right.
know, and you know, pushing ourselves into challenges that we didn't know whether these routes would go, you know,
mm-hmm.
and I mean, now sure, you know, it's easy to walk from Nankweep down to well, whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
in 3 days. If you know the route's there and there's a trail, I mean, now
right.
there's trails in many places. And so, you know, having that, you lose a lot of that sense of exploration, and it just becomes like, well, an endurance test, you know. Yeah, well, we hiked the length of the Grand Canyon. And I'm not saying it. Look, I would like to do that myself, but quite honestly, I don't have the interest in just doing that,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Right.
And I'd rather... I've got so many other things I'd rather do, like climb buttes and stuff like that, that I just don't have, and do my work.
Right.
I'm still gainfully employed, so I don't get that much time off for those kinds of big trips. But,
so,
but anyways,
so
you know,
going,
I understand
going
what people
back
wanted.
To the mid-70s here, did you spend any time going back to the same hike twice, or were you really trying to do, oh, we've done that, now let's go do this?
You mean, no, we never did the same hike twice, but there's one hike I'll tell you about, maybe two, well, maybe in a few days or weeks, but that I would love to do over again, but, and they're longer hikes, but we would never go back and do the same objective because there was always something else to do, you know, but having said that, you know, quite often, if you were going to go into upper Nankweep Valley,
mm-hmm.
you know, you had to go down the Nankweep Trail
right,
or the Marion Sieber route, you know,
right,
and so,
right.
you know, these became basically just trade routes, right? They were the access routes.
Right.
And
right.
So we would redo those trails. I mean, I've probably done Nankweep Trail like 30 times, you know, over the years.
But
and,
you were going
and,
30
uh,
different places. That's different than going down the Hermit and out the South Kaibab 30 times.
Yeah, for sure. For
trying
sure.
to trying
and
to do
that would,
loop.
Yeah, that really has no appeal to me, and so we did go into these areas multiple times but for different objectives, and you know, my first couple of trips into the Horse Thief and Nankweep area were, you know, to look at opportunities for climbing but basically to get the trails in, like the first time I went down Nankweep Trail, I just went down the trail so that, you know, I could say I did it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I climbed Nankweep Butte because it was right there, and then explored a little bit upstream but not you know, to the extent that subsequent trips let me do. And so, yeah, I mean, I think back now, I look at my map here of Nankweep Creek, and you know, I've been up every arm here. I've got I've got lines drawn up showing all the arms that, you know, I, as far as I could get up into them, and
right.
And that could never have happened in the time I had available, could never have happened in one trip. That's
right.
a result of
right.
you know, 10 different trips, right?
Yeah.
So,
yeah,
yeah.
Okay,
but.
So what are the first ascents did you make in that 1976, 1977 period?
Oh, yeah, right. So that was where the time we're looking at there. Yeah, so I mentioned Nanqui Butte just a few minutes ago there, and I was interested in getting up these unclimbed summits that I thought, ones I thought were unclimbed. There was no definitive list or anything like that, but we would talk amongst ourselves. Well, Butcher got up this butte, and Butcher got up that butte, and Al Doty got up that one, and so there were some that were, conspicuously unknown, like Quaggan, and another one was what is it, Galeros Butte, and that was a nice one that I enjoyed. It's a rather small butte. It's pretty diminutive. It really, it's no, it's not much. It's just a kind of a pimple on the ridge, coming southeast from Gunther, but it is named, right? So it
That's
was an
right.
objective. And I remember thinking, well, I remember at the time I was enrolled as an undergraduate in the geology program at the University of Arizona in Tucson. And so I was starting to learn a lot about the geology, and I was very interested in the geology of Colorado Plateau and Grand Canyon geology. So on one of these trips down the Nanquip, I went into the canyon there, and I remember the first day or first free day, I think it was, after I got down there, I went up Nanquip Butte. I'm sorry, Nanquip Mesa. I'd already been up the butte, but I went up Nanquip Mesa, and I'm sure you've been up that a number of times. I haven't been up it since that trip in 76, I guess,
Okay.
77. And I remember at that time I stumbled across, I didn't know anything about the route. I knew that Butchert had been up it and others, but I stumbled across this brilliantly constructed, I say that tongue in cheek, deer trail. And I actually considered that maybe Powell's party or Walcott's party had actually constructed a trail up there, because the deer had utilized the slabs, the sloping slabs in the Coconino, so beautifully to interact, interlock these switchbacks, that it looked like it had to be a man-made trail, And
Wow.
I was just blown away by it. It was really kind of magical, to see to see how the intuition of the deer, linked up the easiest route and resulted in this just near perfect trail construction. So,
Yeah.
I mean, that was an aspect of that trip. And then, of course, so what I wanted to do, in addition to Galeros, was I thought that Burke Point was unclimbed, and so and Burke Point is another point that, from the rim, it doesn't look like anything, but when you're down below it, looking up,
Right.
it looks very imposing. And so it's a red walled butte that has a fairly straightforward approach and climb. And I finally got to the top of it, and the first ascent party, which I think was Ullman and Packard, had been there like 2 weeks before me.
Oh,
So
wow.
it was like very kind of frustrating, and I think that might have been the first time I'd run across Jim Ullman's name. I don't recall if I knew of him before that. So
Okay.
it was certainly early on in my acquaintance with Jim. And
Did
but
you?
then so then I went down and I continued south, and this was a solo trip, by the way.
Okay.
And I went over the passes into Malgosa Creek,
Okay.
and on a long day hike, I went up Galeros Butte.
Okay.
And that was really cool, because at that point I started to know the geology of the canyon better. And there's a 60 mile, what used to be called 60 mile formation, is crops out very extensively in that basin. And this is the 60 mile creek drainage, and of course that's the type section, in other words, the best locality where that particular geological unit is displayed. So
Right.
that was all making an impression on me, right, from a geological perspective. And
Hey,
I
Jim.
managed to get up Galeros, and it was a challenging third.
I got hang on a second. I got a couple questions for you.
Yeah.
Did you must have summited these buttes, I mean like Burke Point, and you'd find this piece of paper maybe from Ullman and Packard. Would you did you try to reach out to those guys to try to see what they were doing, or were you just knew they were there, and you were gonna, you know, do what you did, and they were doing what they did, and you'd kind of keep an eye out for them?
Yeah, I think it was more the latter, Tom, not because we didn't want to have contact with these people, but it would say Jim Ullman, you know, maybe it might say Flagstaff, AZ, right?
Right.
And it's like, well, I mean, I guess I could have gone into Flagstaff and found the phone.
Trying to look the guy down.
Yeah, you know, it was just not that easy necessarily to keep track, you know, to get in touch with people.
Right.
I could have, you know, called up my friend Bruce Grubbs, who by that time was running the Mountaineer.
Okay.
The Alpineer. I'm sorry, it was called the Alpineer in Flagstaff. And, you know, I could have said, you know, a guy named Jim Ullman. Could have done all those things, you know. But I wasn't methodical enough at that point to, I mean, I wish I had, quite honestly. It would have been really great to connect with these guys. I never actually connected with Jim. This is kind of an aside. Until that Sindicato Grand Canyon Climbing Conference in Flagstaff about 5 years ago. I think that's where I first met you, too.
Okay, that's
directly.
Right. Yeah.
I met Jim there for the first time directly. We had corresponded before that, but it was great to meet with him, and we chatted. And I remember he told me that, you know, it was kind of interesting because he said when he and his colleagues like Kirsch Fink,
mm-hmm.
and Ken Walters and that was the main crew, I guess, were climbing in the 70s. He said we basically, you know, would run across once in a while, you know, my name in a register before him, right? And so they didn't know how to get in touch with me either, right? And so it was kind of, we knew about these people, but we didn't really have direct communication with them. And
got it.
And I remember one Ullman told me that when they first, he said when we first found out about the trip that Bruce Grubbs and I had taken into Ahwatubi and Temple and Char, I think that he talked to Bruce in Flagstaff directly about this.
Hmm.
And he said we were blown away because here's these guys from down Southern California, Southern Arizona,
right.
Myself, and of course Bruce, who was in Flagstaff, come into the canyon and doing like a 9-day trip and checking off multiple summits. You know,
right.
Before that, everybody's thinking was kind of like you got to go in with your objective of this peak and get up it, and then you'd leave, right,
yeah.
And go home.
Yeah.
And he said that they were really impressed by that, but again, nobody had the connections at that point beyond just superficial.
Yeah.
I shouldn't
okay.
say superficial, but
and
you
then
know,
I did want to ask, who was your structural geology professor?
Good question. Yeah, so I'm not a structural geologist, right? That's
okay.
not my forte.
But did you have to take that class?
You have to take that.
Yeah.
And so that's every geologist, every undergraduate geologist has to take a structural geology course for, you know, for very good reason. And so at the University of Arizona at that time, the structural geology professor, the undergraduate professor who taught, had just quit. I forget who that was.
Okay.
But they had a guy there who was an instructor, and his name was Doug Schakel, and I think he's passed away now. I recall seeing an obituary for him, I believe. So, but this was kind of a transition because the department was working to bring in another faculty member named George Davis,
right.
who became very, very established and well known as a structural geologist. Based in Southern Arizona.
That's
right. A world-class researcher.
Excellent instructor, just an amazing guy.
Yeah, wrote a great textbook on structural geology, which I still have and refer to. But he was going to come arrive at Tucson the year that I graduated, right?
Okay.
So I didn't want to, if I had waited to take his course in structural geology, I would have had to extend my career another, I mean, my degree program another year.
We
right?
must have
because
just
I
missed
would've...
each other because I did get a course from, I did get structural geology from Davis, and that probably
oh, really?
Was in 78 maybe or 79.
Wow. So you were an undergraduate there at
yeah.
Tucson?
At U of A, yeah. But that was
yeah,
that was
well,
long ago and far away because I was thinking, wait a minute, I got structural geology from Davis, and I was thinking if you know, whoever taught you structural geology, if you had told them, oh, I'm hiking around Grand Canyon, I've seen this, I've seen that, they would have been very interested in what you were doing.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. And but, you know, I didn't really volunteer all that kind of information to, you know, there were very few people that were kind of interested in it. And so, you know, and quite honestly, as an undergraduate, I was kind of in awe of the faculty members, even Doug Shakel. And it wasn't like, you know, eventually I kind of learned how to loosen up in, and participate in those kinds of interactions, but more so as a graduate student in California. But I do want to say that, you know, I said that I would wanted to take the course from George Davis, and of course I did, no question about that. But Doug Shakel's course was very good. I really enjoyed it. It was very strongly field based. Every weekend we'd have projects in the field, and of course you can do that in Arizona in the winter, you know. And so he, you know, he was a very good teacher and educator.
Yes.
So I felt like I didn't, you know, I don't feel like I suffered anything from having to take his structural geology course.
No, not at all. I mean, he had quite the good reputation as well. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So that's what I was thinking. So sorry, I got off. I got you off track there. But
no, that's
but,
no problem.
Galeros Butte, and so near Gunther. When you climbed Burke Point, and Galeros, did you climb Gunther as well?
No, I didn't climb Gunther because basically to get up Gunther, you more or less have to come from Char Creek,
okay.
unless there's
right.
been some new route that I'm not familiar with from the east side. So it's more of a challenge. And besides, I knew that Gunther had been climbed right by Butcher.
Okay.
So it wasn't a prime objective at that point. At that time, I was only interested in climbing. I won't say only, but primarily interested in climbing the unclimbed buttes.
Got
right.
It.
Those were my objectives. That would be the destination. You know, if you could pick something else on the way, that would be fine. But Gunther had to wait to a later time. So,
okay.
So that was a really, really great trip, you know, that I did solo in the spring there, and knocked off a couple of summits, three at least that I can recall. So, and then that fall, in the fall of 78, in December, I think it was, right after Christmas, I'm not quite sure exactly, but Bruce Grubbs and I decided we wanted to do the ski tour in from the North Rim. And this had been done once before by some people from Flagstaff. Scott Baxter,
yep.
I don't know if you must have run into Scott.
Oh, yes.
I think, and Lee Dexter and
okay.
a party had done this ski tour. And so we'd heard about this ski tour, and it sounded fantastic, you know, to ski in from Jacob Lake Lodge to the North Rim
right.
and then walk to the south. So Bruce talked me into it, and the two of us did it, and it was just, you know, one of these. I wasn't much of a skier, per se. You know, this is when cross country skiing, you know, skating as a technique of cross country skiing was starting to become introduced, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I mean, with skating, you can move a lot faster on cross country skis than with the traditional stride, and
right.
and. Because I grew up or spent most of my time in southern Arizona, I didn't have access to the snow in the winter, and so I never became a really proficient skier. Got okay once I got to Canada, but you know, in Arizona, I was not going to be skating down Jacob Blake Highway there, right? So, but Bruce, you know, was patient, and we did that tour. I think we did it in 3 days.
Wow.
Two nights, maybe. Maybe it was 3 nights. And I remember at one point, this might get me into trouble too. We spent a night in the lodge there at the Kaibab Lodge, right?
Okay.
So it's to the west of the gas station.
Yeah.
You know where that is?
Yep.
Yeah. And we skied in there, and it was like 25 below zero.
Hmm.
And we skied over to the cabins there, and we actually found a way into one of the cabins, and we didn't break anything, but there was a way to get in, and so we went into this cabin and bunked down for the night.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, it was a little bit warmer inside there than outside.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, kind of a little shelter and refuge. But the next morning we skied back over to the gas station there, and just south of it, so you're pretty close to the entrance station.
Yes.
And I remember Bruce had a little thermometer, and he pulled it out, and it was bright sun, and it was 28 below Fahrenheit.
Gee.
And you know, we were sitting there sweating shortly after stopping, and but it was bright sun and just really cold, and so it was just a really spectacular trip down there. When we came to the rim, we had to head down the trail, of course, no big deal. So
right.
we put our skis onto our backpacks and tied them together at the top. And of course, at the top of the North Kaibab Trail in the winter, there was a lot of overhanging brush, right?
Uh-huh. Oh boy!
Because willows and stuff like that would get bogged down by snow, so they would kind of bend down over the trail.
Right.
So it was really, really a challenge to get through the first couple of miles, or maybe even a few hundred meters, I suppose, of the trail until it got down in elevation such that there wasn't as much snow or anything like that on the obstructing the route. But I remember we got to the Red Wall, and, you know, the Red Wall is actually cut out of the limestone there. The trail is cut out of the limestone in several places, and there was this one spot. We came around a corner, and there was a wall of ice that had filled the trail, which was undercut. So you had a roof of red wall above you, and then the wall where the trail had been excavated, and then the flat trail floor, and then the cliff. And so the ice just came right down from above and went straight down over the cliff. And we didn't have any equipment like crampons or, you know, an ice screw or anything like that to protect it, not even a rope, actually, because we didn't have any objective to climb on this ski tour. So we were like looking at this thinking, my God, you know, there's no way. It's like you'd have to be, you know, there's no way we can get around this ice boss on the trail. And you know, at that point you're kind of thinking, we're in a dicey situation here, because this trail is cut out of the cliff for a reason, right? There's no obvious easy ways to get around it. And so I started thinking, well, I know I've been down the old Kaibab Trail,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
which starts about four miles to the northeast, I guess.
Right.
We figure we can get down that. But then we backtracked a little bit, and I could see this gully going down. It was a fault gully, and I thought, well, I wonder if we can get down that and maybe up the other side and bypass this ice boss.
Uh-huh.
And so that's exactly what we did. We were able to scramble down this very steep fault ravine and then get to a place where we could cross that drainage on a ledge, and then we went up the ravine on the other side and bypass the ice boss. So
nice.
it worked out well. So
hmm.
Oh, and then another at the end of that trip, you know, this is back to my paranoia about park rangers and permits. You know, we did not have a permit for this tour, and so we were coming down the trail, and you know, by the time you hit Roaring Springs, I think there was actually a ranger there we didn't run into him or her, but I think they had somebody based there during the winter.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But we were worried that we might run into a ranger. So when we got down towards Cottonwood Creek, I remember we decided that we would, you know, we wanted to minimize our contact with potential contact with people in the corridor trail. So we hiked up to the Tonto,
okay.
The Tonto platform above the Tapiz,
right.
And then followed that around all the way down to the Clear Creek Trail by Sumner Butte,
okay.
And then dropped down the Clear Creek Trail to back into Bright Angel Canyon.
Hmm.
So we still had to go through the
main heart of
the main
Phantom
area
Ranch.
There,
yeah.
Phantom Ranch, right, with our skis on there, but nobody stopped us, right?
Okay.
So
uh-huh.
One person asked if they were paddles,
because
they thought we might be taking a boat across the river, and we said, mm-hmm. No, they're skis, and then we booked it up. Oh, this story is coming back. It gets better and better now that mm-hmm. I think about it. So we had left my car at the El Tovar Hotel, right?
Okay.
So our plan was to come up and come up the Bright Angel with our skis on,
right.
Our packs, and
right.
then go to the car and then head back down south. And we finally got to the car late in the evening, and there's a note late in the afternoon, there's a note on the windshield, and it says, "Mr. Haggard, please contact us as soon as you finish your hike." And it's some ranger's name, you know, with a phone number.
Huh.
Of course, you know, my heart goes into my throat at this point, right? And so I said, well, let's just pretend we didn't get that note, right? So we headed east on the roads, you know, and we were going to head over, and we headed over to the East Rim Drive because we were going to go back that way. I don't know why that way as opposed to the southerly route. But we got all the way to the entrance station. And we're out of the park and heading south on the road. And it was like a big kind of breath of relaxation, right? And I look in my rearview mirror, and there's red lights flashing, right?
Oh,
but by this time, it was pretty much almost dark. And I said, oh, no, you know. So pull over, and the ranger comes over, and he says, are you Mr. Haggard? And I said, yeah. And he says, well, yeah, we've been wanting to talk to you, you know. We saw your car up there, and it was parked for quite a while, and we were just wondering what it might be, and so we ran the license plate, and we got a hold of your sister in Phoenix, and she said she didn't know anything about your hike, and she was very, you know, when we told her you were missing in the Grand Canyon, or what we were wondering where you were in the Grand Canyon, she got very worried, and then she said, well, it was probably just my brother taking one of his hikes, you know. So they actually just wanted to confirm that we were okay, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't say anything about a permit because it was obvious that we didn't have one because we weren't in their files, right?
Right?
And he was very polite with us and just wanted to confirm that everything was okay and that, you know, we were indeed safe. And so it was kind of another interesting
nice.
Little...
Yeah.
Permit story there that weaved into that one. So.
Well, it's interesting because the Park Service would have known who was really exploring the resource, and there were a number of people in the park that were really happy that people were out there exploring and looking around and hiking here and there. So interesting. I mean, it wasn't all just, well, we're going to give you a ticket because you were hiking and you didn't have a permit. And so in a way, the Park Service was kind of like, all right, there's Haggard, there's his vehicle. This is a guy that we see a lot. His vehicle's around a lot. And, you know, we'll just make sure he comes out.
Yeah, that's true. And to their credit, too, whenever we ran, I mentioned earlier how I would have casual visits with rangers.
Mm-hmm.
And they really wanted to know about what we were doing. You know, they
right.
wanted to know the routes.
Right.
And where people could go, where people had gone, and because they wanted to document this and to add to the knowledge base for the parks,
right?
Right? So that they would have a better information base upon which to manage the resource,
sure.
the hiking
sure.
resource.
You bet.
So yeah, it was I think if it, you know, if I'd had, if maybe if I'd lived in Flagstaff at the time, I'm sure I would have had more direct connections with people who worked at the park and lived up there, and probably would have, you know, we would have talked more about this, and right. it might have resulted in some sort of, you know, enhancement of understanding. Let's put it that way.
It's funny because Harvey Butchert and Dan Davis had a good reputation. Davis was working for the Park Service. He was the Inter Canyon Ranger. And this is in the 1950s. And those guys shared a lot of data. Davis did a lot of hiking. So that relationship can be made and is still being made today. But there's an institutional memory problem from the Park Service because, you know, one employee moves out to another park, and new person comes in and has to do all the hikes and get familiar with the area. Versus an individual like yourself who comes back to the Grand Canyon and hikes it through the decades, you know, as they're basing their life in something else outside the Park Service.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting just pondering that.
Yeah, that is pretty neat. And I know these rangers were kind of frustrated that we weren't utilizing the permit system because mm-hmm. It, you know, that was information that they were not getting, and they did not hold it against us right. from the point of view that they wanted to arrest us or anything like that. Right. I don't believe, right? Yeah. I mean, some people did get challenged once in a while, I guess, and as I mentioned earlier, my friend Art eventually got busted. But you know, by and large, it was you know, a live and let live relationship, and as long as we didn't get caught too many times, I guess,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And as long as we had some information that we could share with them and provide them, you know, it was kind of a symbiotic thing. So,
right.
So okay. yeah, it was.
So
I kind of wish them well. It'd be interesting to talk with these with those fellows now. And I say fellows because that was pretty much all my interaction with parks personnel then was with men. You know,
right.
There was one female park ranger who was a friend of Bruce Grubbs, and Janet was her name, but I forget her last name. But she basically, as far as I know, she just kind of worked in like administration
mm-hmm.
and didn't okay. spend a whole lot of time out on the trail. So there wasn't a lot of interaction then. So
okay,
but it was pretty much a male oriented organization then. So
So when did you summit? Your first summit of Quaggan.
Yeah. So, by the way, I wanted to mention, Tom, that last week, I believe it was, I gave you the name of Art Christensen.
Yes.
And in one of our discussions here, and I misspelled Art's last name.
Okay.
So I wanted to give you the correct last name spelling now.
Please.
So that, just for the record, it's C-H-R-I-S-T-I-A-N. S-E-N.
Thank you.
Yeah, so I want Art to know that I do know his last name. So.
Yes.
But I hardly, you know, with email, you never you don't type people's names anymore,
right.
or their addresses, right?
Right.
Nor their phone numbers. And so
that's right.
You kind of lose all this basic information. So,
yeah.
But Quaggan was that we knew that was going to be a serious undertaking. And, you know, Bruce and I,
hang on, because we've been at this a little over an hour, and I'm like, okay, I want the Quaggan story, but what I want to do is I want to try to put it into a timeline. What year did you
right.
summit that?
Well, Quaggan was in March of 79.
Okay, great.
1979.
Great. So you know what let's do now? Maybe this is a good time to put a comma in this oral history series. Since we just got you across the North Rim, down the trail up the other side of the El Tovar and home again with
mm-hmm.
a ranger pulling you over to make sure you were all right. Maybe this is a good time to stop this one. And the next time we'll pick it up, we'll start in with Quaggan because that follows right along there.
Okay, sure. However you want to do it, it sounds good to me.
Yeah. Cause I don't want to rush that. So with that, why don't we conclude part 6, Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Jim Haggart. Today is Sunday, February 28th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. Jim, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom. I really appreciate the opportunity.